Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Governor Chris Sununu begins his second term as Democrats in the House and Senate consider their top priorities. House lawmakers ban guns inside Representatives Hall. And a restaurant and the city of Keene debate whether the restaurant's name is offensive. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we'll talk about them in this hour. Give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. We're also broadcasting a live video of this radio program today. Very easy to listen and watch on Facebook. Again, just search for NHPR Exchange on Facebook, and you'll see the live video happening there. You can also comment in the comments field, and we can bring you into the conversation that way. Joining me at the table today, three people who know a lot about what's been going on this week. Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Ethan DeWitt for the Concord Monitor, and Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here today.
Hey, Peter.
Happy to be here.
Good morning.
So again, listeners, phone number for you to call to join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. So let's start by talking about Governor Sununu and the beginning of his second term. He started his second term yesterday and has, as part of his opening remarks, he called for bipartisan cooperation.
In November, you know, the voters in this state, not just for governor, but as they came out, whether it was for the county seats, or the state seats, or the House, or the Senate, they really set us on a path. And it does require that we, as state leaders, come together, truly embrace a spirit of cooperation, work together to get things done for the state of New Hampshire. And we have to remember that there are 1.35 million people counting on that, and they truly deserve nothing less.
And Governor Sununu went on to discuss a variety of issues, mental health, DCYF staffing, workforce development, business taxes, and the economy. Start with you, Dean. What stood out to you in this inaugural address?
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, the comparison was to his inaugural at the beginning of his first term, which was fairly extemporaneous, about 20 minutes long. This time he went for about an hour or so. He did some extemporaneous storytelling, but it was a much more structured speech. And what was interesting to me was the first 20 minutes or so was really him laying out his working philosophy of politics over the next 2 years, really how he wants to see the governor's office and the state legislature interact. And he talked about the possibility that this divided government was something chosen by voters, that they were looking for a spirit of cooperation. And he talked about the New Hampshire way, and he drew some implicit comparisons, or explicit comparisons, actually, between New Hampshire and a lot of the acrimony and partisanship in D.C. And he talked about civility and forming individual relationships and people stepping out of their comfort zone. And he went back to some familiar themes about management and customer service. So we really got a sense of kind of where he was in terms of wanting bipartisanship. That said, he moved on to this sort of longer laundry list of policy priorities, which a lot of that will be fleshed out in the budget address in February. You know, he covered the whole range of issues that we typically expect: social services, education, healthcare, energy, et cetera, and just a lot of different priorities. And I think what was interesting to me is, I think Democrats will agree on a number of these priorities, but as is always the case, the devil is going to be in the details. I think there are real disagreements about given a particular priority, whether it's energy or education funding, how to move that forward. And that's where the real disagreement is going to be. So there was some cautious optimism among Democrats. They felt the speech was a little bit general, but we'll get more detail in the budget proposal.
Okay. Ethan, what do you think?
Sure. And just to kind of build off of that, obviously the governor was speaking to two audiences. As he kind of alluded to, he is facing a divided government. So he was looking to his own Republican backbenchers, but also to the new Democratic majorities in the House and Senate. And what he seemed to be saying is that I stand aligned with you and both parties on these priorities, But I have a specific way that that we did the budget last year, and I want to carry that forward into the next year. He kind of talked about how the tax business tax decreases should continue, that the budget should stay revenue neutral, and that any of these these improvements to healthcare, to mental health, to substance use disorder treatment should come from one-off spending. And so we was kind of signaling to both sides that I'll stand, you know, I support all these priorities as long as they're done in a fiscally responsible way, and trying to kind of play to both crowds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there were moments where Democrats were really appreciative of things that he said, moments where not so much. Listeners, this is the part of the show where we want you to weigh in on the inaugural address, the priorities the governor laid out. Give us a call now if you'd like to participate. The number is 1-800-892-6477. What were you happy to hear the governor say in his speech yesterday? Or what did you wish he said? 1-800-892-6477. One of the moments in the speech yesterday, Sununu touted the state's Medicaid expansion work requirement with a bit of a warning tossed in for the benefit of Democrats now controlling the legislature.
The provisions of Medicaid help lift people out of poverty by empowering them with the dignity of work and self-reliability. They help people gain skills necessary for long-term independence and success and entrance into the long-term workforce. We have designed a New Hampshire solution that was the result of a strong bipartisan agreement, and this legislature needs to be sure not to obstruct its implementation.
So an applause line there, but hey, Democrats, don't mess with this work requirement. Dean, does that seem to be what you're saying?
Yeah, this is going to be a really interesting area of potential conflict. We're seeing there are a number of states, I think 14 or 15, that are putting work requirements into effect with expanded Medicaid. The implementation has been really uneven. There's been some significant reporting problems and people being bumped off of Medicaid kind of precipitously. So we'll see how this plays out in New Hampshire. It may go smoothly. There was general bipartisan agreement in the end on it, even though there was a little bit of controversy. But the issue is going to be in the implementation, and I think we're going to be talking about this a lot over the next year.
Well, really, in the modern era, this is a one-off, right? A Republican governor with Democratic control in all levels of state government. That we haven't had that happen here in New Hampshire in over 100 years. Mm-hmm. So Sununu has to – it's really a balancing act for him. And I think in this speech, he was also trying to signal to Republicans that – When it comes to fiscally conservative principles, I'm not going to abandon you. And that's really important because his success as governor with the Democrats in control is really all about, can he sustain vetoes if he has to draw the line on issues? And he has the numbers right now to do that. I mean, that's the difference we see now from the last time we had this kind of divided government. When John Lynch was governor in 2010, the Republicans had 3-1 majorities in both the House and the Senate. They overrode Lynch more than any governor in modern history since World War II. There were more veto fights that Lynch ended up losing. It really ended up driving him out of office. He really enjoyed that job. He served in it longer than any governor in modern history, 4 terms. But it became an unpleasant place for him to work. And I think Sununu is not going to find that here because he has a Republican backstop.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, he did bring up the Medicaid expansion work requirement. That was a little bit of a shot across the bow because Democrats say they are putting forward legislation to kind of tweak that requirement. But he did. There were a lot of topics that he didn't address, potentially to keep that kind of balance moving forward. Hot button issues like marijuana. He didn't touch on any gun legislation. He didn't touch on paid family leave, which Democrats say they're going to bring back. One of his biggest applause lines was he kind of emphatically said that he would not support any income or sales taxes of any kind, which is, of course, something that people of both parties support, but may have been a little bit of a signal with regards to paid family leave, which he's long called a backdoor income tax.
Yeah, let's hear from Senate President Donna Susie, because she said she was happy to hear the governor was willing to work on some issues in a bipartisan manner, but there was still more that she would have liked to hear from him.
The governor probably could have talked a little bit about some of the issues impacting families, one that he knows will be coming up, paid family medical leave. That's something that I think he chose not to to address, but is something that he probably should have because it's definitely a number one priority in both the House and Senate.
Do you see any common ground with the governor with respect to paid family leave?
The governor has said that he's willing to look at the program. He did raise some objections in the past legislative session. Some of those suggestions have been incorporated into the bill that Senator Dan Feltes has sponsored. So I do think there are some areas. Overall, we're going to debate the threshold of the number of employees a business has to have. And there are some other details that we're going to continue to look at. But we remain committed to ensuring, as I said, that families have opportunities to succeed and to thrive in this state. And one of the barriers to that oftentimes is having to choose between going to your job and caring for young children or elderly parents who need you.
That's Donna Soucy. I spoke with her yesterday on All Things Considered in response to the governor's inaugural address. Dean Spiliotis.
Yeah, family medical leave, I think, is exactly the kind of issue we're talking about, where there's general agreement on priorities, but there are real differences in what the program should look like, who should be responsible for funding it, what kind of a future expense should it be for state government. So, you know, there's potential there for some sort of agreement, but there's also potential for both sides to dig in. I think one other, we're talking about sort of the economic dimension here. I think one other important theme in all of this is Governor Sununu touting New Hampshire's economy, which is doing quite well. It has been for some time. But the issue of tax cuts, business tax cuts, some are already in effect. There's another round scheduled to go into effect. He has staked a lot of his economic message on these cuts. I think for Democrats to try to roll back the earlier cuts, that's politically very difficult. But we'll see whether they try to stop the next round. And so this whole issue of revenue and businesses versus individuals, I think, is going to be an ongoing theme in the legislature.
Yeah, let's hear exactly what the governor had to say, his stern warning on taxes.
The last thing we should be doing is raising taxes or pushing a budget that doesn't live in our means. And it goes without saying, there will be no sales or income tax under my watch.
So, stern warning on taxes. Ethan, was that actually a legit threat that we were going to get a sales or income tax under this new legislator?
Well, again, there certainly hasn't been anything explicit. And if you talk to any Democrat, they would say absolutely not. What you didn't see actually all Democrats rise for that line, though. And, you know, whatever, read into that what you will. As I said, he may be kind of signaling his position on paid family leave. But on taxes and on paid family leave, I think just a theme you might see in the legislature is the Senate Democrats seem to be a bit more accommodating to the governor's vision than the House Democrats are. For instance, on tax cuts, the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, Representative Susan Almy, has proposed reversing the tax, the business profits tax, back to 8.5%. It's at 7.9%. The Senate Democrats, meanwhile, do not want to reverse and kind of increase the taxes back. They just want to keep it at 7.9% and stop further reductions. Mm-hmm. And that's one area that you're seeing a little bit of a kind of meeting the governor halfway. Also on paid family leave, the Senate's proposal for paid family leave fits a lot more with the governor's vision for a public-private partnership than does the House version. So these are just little differences that you'll see play out over the next session.
Another issue that came up during the inaugural address yesterday, Sununu said the state will soon release its new 10-year mental health plan, its second 10-year plan. And he mentioned how he plans to handle a particular aspect of the state's mental health system that has long been contentious. And that prompted some of the loudest applause during the speech.
And in the coming weeks, we will be releasing the state's new 10-year mental health plan, which is a practical roadmap to quality mental health care. This year, I'm very excited about this one. We're going to accomplish something that has been talked about for decades, but for whatever reason, we quite haven't gotten around to. We will move the state psychiatric unit out of the state prison and treat those patients with the dignity and respect they deserve.
So this was quite surprising to a lot of folks, that well-received in the mental health community, that the governor would sort of put his name out there and say, look, I'm going to try and get this done. Dean, were you surprised to hear this part?
This is, as the governor correctly said, this has been a big issue for people. There's been a lot of media coverage about the situation. You know, the question is going to be where, you know, we've had mental health plans in the past, these long-term plans, and there's they've been a bit contentious at times, and it feels like New Hampshire's been trying to make up a lot of ground. So, you know, one of the issues that will the questions will be, you know, where will they move it? You know, where will it be housed? What the cost will be, et cetera. But certainly something very popular with both parties, given the current context.
One of the things that's interesting about this proposal is, as Dean alluded to, the site is critical. Finding a site, a place where a community, by the way, will accept this kind of facility, that, as we know, with a lot of correctional buildings, that's not always an easy thing to get a community to go along with it. But also is just the financing of care for these folks in a different facility. The belief has been for a number of years from proponents of this concept is that actually there may be more federal Medicaid money available to the state of New Hampshire if they're treating these folks in a psychiatric hospital setting instead of in a prison setting. So I think that's going to require a lot of exploration by this legislature as well, is how financially this would work. Could it be a net plus for us once we get through the cost of housing the facility?
Listeners, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. And in just a moment, we're going to talk about the sexual harassment training that's gone on in the House. House lawmakers have made the training mandatory, and seems like this year's session was better attended than previously. Should it be mandatory in your view? Tell us your thoughts. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. You could also send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Also this week, as expected, the new Democratic majority in the House of Representatives voted to ban deadly weapons from the House chamber and surrounding rooms in the State House. The rule passed 220 votes to 163. Majority Leader Douglas Lay says there have been too many incidents of mishandled or dropped firearms in the State House.
This is an issue of gun safety and public safety. We don't want to wait until there is a problem, because if we do that, we are waiting until there is a tragedy.
Republicans, however, were not happy about this. Many say they have received death threats, and if they can't carry the guns with them in the State House, they can't protect themselves or visitors to the State House, visitors including students. Here's David Love. He's a freshman representative from Derry.
Take a look up in the gallery and just imagine if some madman or madwoman got up in there. The children that were mentioned, they'd be gone. Most of us would be hit. There'd be a bloodbath. The blood would be knee-deep here.
So, Ethan, what were your thoughts of this debate? Pretty predictable, or?
Well, I think the passion that was brought to the debate was perhaps stronger than maybe people had anticipated. That might have to do with the political climate of a change in parties and kind of setting a tone. In terms of the actual issue coming up, it is actually fairly predictable. This is, as one representative, Alda Baldessaro, put it on the floor, this is ping-ponged in the last few years. There wasn't actually a policy on firearms in the on the State House floor until I think it was about 2009 under Speaker Terry Norelli. She implemented a ban on firearms. Then Republican Speaker Bill O'Brien undid that ban, and then Speaker Norelli, when she came back as Speaker, reinstated the ban, and then Republican Speaker Sean Jasper undid it, and now we're in 2019. So, I mean, you know, guns are always a hot topic. And with the recent spate of shootings, there may have been more passion infused in this debate, but the move by the Democrats could be seen from miles away.
Let's go to the calls on this and talk to Stillwater in Boscawen. Thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much for taking the call. I'd like to take this debate back a little bit and take it away from gun control specifically. If you have you had a representative who got up and spoke after the vote, and he stated that he was going to carry regardless, I think he should step down. The reason for that is he's undermining the entire political process. It's not a Democratic issue. It's not a Republican issue. Here comes along the legislature. They create a law. It's voted on. And the guns are banned. He comes up and says, well, you know, we just voted on this, but I'm going to disregard it. Now, my kids heard that and said, well, if you make the laws and you don't pay attention to it, why make the laws? Why have laws?
That's a really good...
It doesn't make any sense. It undermines the power of the police. It totally causes a lot of disrespect for everything that is in power and that we stand for.
Yeah, well, Stillwater, thank you very much for your comments. I really appreciate it. I want to put it to the panel. So, yeah, I heard this too. Some lawmakers said, I'm still going to concealed carry because I feel unsafe. Dean, what do you make of this?
Yeah, there were a couple of lawmakers who said that they would continue to do that, and they apparently had done so in the past as well. You know, this is just going to continue on going back and forth. As Ethan said, it's been about 10 years now. I think the most recent period was 4 years in which you could carry that has just come to an end. And you know, this is a litmus test between Republicans and Democrats. It's you know, the Democrats argue that it's a recipe for a tragedy, somebody dropping a gun and inadvertently shooting a fourth grader who's touring the chamber, and Republicans say no, it's an opportunity to stop a potentially a mass tragedy. And until it kind of we have some sort of empirical movement one way or the other, I just don't know how it's going to be resolved. But it was interesting. I heard those comments, and I don't know whether there was any kind of pushback against those individuals or, in fact, how this would be enforced if it's just the honor system or there's some sort of metal detectors that might be used.
Yeah, I was just going to jump on that. The caller does raise some big questions on enforcement. How does this actually carry out in practice? I mean, if you have concealed carry, I mean, there's feasibly, and this was brought up in debate, it will be hard to notice whether someone is carrying a firearm.
Do either of you guys know how it's been done in the past? Is it just simply honor code?
Yeah, I mean, the rule doesn't allow any members on the floor to be searched for weapons. So they can be carrying a gun if they want to. And we're one of only four state houses in the country that doesn't have metal detectors. Yeah. Then, and that's obviously what would solve this issue, is if you had to go through a metal detector to get through into the building, then your gun would be confiscated.
And you have further questions about, you know, the rule allows for arrest or ejection. How arrest would play out is a little bit unclear and something that would have to probably be fleshed out in the moment, and that would be very interesting to watch.
Right. And also worth noting before the break that on the first day of the new legislative session, House lawmakers adopted a rule mandating attendance at anti-harassment training. The measure adopted Wednesday got bipartisan support, but several Republicans, including Representative Jim Belanger of Hollis, objected to the change.
After you get elected by your constituents to represent your constituents, there should be no other qualifications you need to meet to remain an elected person.
So his argument is, look, we've met the requirements. We've been elected by the voters. Why should we have to do all this, quote unquote, mandatory stuff, even if it's important, like sexual harassment training?
Sure. So this was not an issue that's ping-ponged around. This is a new rule, and it comes kind of as the Me Too movement was sort of at its peak last winter. There was a harassment training, and there had been several news articles about incidents of reported harassment that were kind of taken in, and you know, records of them were released to the public with names redacted. So we knew that there were some complaints going on in
specific
the
incidents, but also sort of a culture.
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. And then there was a training that is, you know, held regularly, about annually, and that training, even in the midst of all this heightened media attention, it was in February. Fewer than I counted about 30 people. These are staff members and legislators in a 400-member house showed up. And so the issue was, you know, sort of fresh on Democrats' minds as they took over the chamber, and this rule would now make that mandatory. Again, the enforcement of it is sort of an open question. The rule doesn't specify at all what happens if you don't show up to these trainings. But in the past, current Speaker Steve Shurtleff has kind of raise the prospect of revoking parking privileges and other things.
So this rule is essentially on par with the the no guns rule, the no dangerous weapons rule.
Sure. Yeah, it does. It says that, you know, all members shall attend, you know, these education. They're usually about 2 hours long, these education trainings on you know, what constitutes harassment under the State House harassment policy.
And this really mirrors what's going on in the private sector for some time now. A lot of it is actually done online, but it's often the case that if you work for a corporation or even a university, they require you to do some sort of online online tutorial or workshop dealing with sexual harassment. And I think this rule in particular requires in person, which is a little bit different, mm-hmm. but that's a way to basically see who's showing up.
And one of the arguments kind of made was that by opponents of this rule, which passed overwhelmingly, I should say, in a bipartisan way. But one of the kind of things brought up on the floor was that it was putting everybody through this mandatory training was tantamount to accusing them of wrongdoing before they had done it. But if you actually went to the training itself, the training was actually about 2 hours long, and it was just sort of they just sort of went through what the policy is as written and what it means legally. They had somebody from the Attorney General's office explaining kind of what this means. So it was really kind of an education of what the policy that already exists in the State House and means.
Yeah, worth mentioning. I mean, we're referring to it as sexual harassment training, but it's actually sexual harassment prevention training. Mm-hmm. We got a note from Representative Deborah Altshuler of Rockingham. In Stratum, she wrote in to say, yes, it should be mandatory. Creating a professional working environment for citizens, legislators, staff, and lobbyists is critical to making good public policy. She writes, last session, many lawmakers, citizens coming to Concord to testify, and lobbyists were subjected to inappropriate behavior that ranged from the uncomfortable to the illegal. That's from Democratic Representative Deborah Altshuler. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk with Congressman Chris Pappas. He's now officially New Hampshire's newest congressman, and he's voted for two bills to reopen the government, which is still partially shut down. We'll speak to him in just a moment about his busy first few days. Listeners, if you have questions or comments about the week's news, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Just search for NHPR Exchange. And you can also watch a live video of this radio broadcast. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Our mission is to support the communities we serve, and that's so aligned to what NHPR does.
Wendy Beswick, Vice President of Marketing for Service Credit Union.
Hampshire Public Radio is all about being in the community, talking to the community, and so we feel like it's just a great place for us to get out in front of people who may not know about the credit union.
Learn more about NHPR's corporate support program at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we're taking a look at the busy week in news. Chris Pappas is the newest member of New Hampshire's congressional delegation. The 38-year-old Democrat was sworn in yesterday as the state's first district representative. He replaces fellow Democrat Carol Shea Porter. And there is no shortage of issues to tackle for the freshman lawmaker, including the ongoing partial shutdown. I spoke with Chris Pappas earlier this morning. You voted for two bills that would reopen the government, but because they don't fund the border wall, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he won't take up these bills. Knowing that, what did you hope to accomplish with these bills?
These bills were pegged at the Senate levels that were already passed unanimously by the Republican Senate in December. And I think it's the responsibility of the Senate now to consider the legislation that has already passed through their body. So I'm hopeful that they'll talk about it amongst themselves. It appears that there are at least a couple of Republican senators that are urging Leader McConnell to do the right thing and take up these bills. I hope we have a swift end to this shutdown. Mm-hmm. We should never have gotten to this point. And this is an example of Washington-style politics at its worst. I never thought I'd be coming into Congress, and the first bills we'd be voting on would be ones to reopen the government. We should never let politics get in the way of delivering services to people or getting paychecks to dedicated federal employees. So it's time to end this shutdown, and let's move beyond that and have a substantive discussion about areas where we may agree or disagree.
Well, what about that substantive discussion? What issues could be brought into this negotiation to maybe unclog the logjam here?
Well, I think we always need to hear one another out, but there isn't majority support in the House for the border wall, and there aren't 60 votes in the Senate for the border wall either. So I think the president has to recognize where things stand today. And I think that the government funding should never be used as a tool to prove a political point, which is exactly what's happening here. I think that's really an unfortunate precedent that has been set over the last many years. We've got to get beyond that. Let's not question the services that we provide to people or the paychecks that go to our federal employees. Let's have a discussion, but don't hijack our government as a way to try to get your way.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying that Democrats are not going to blink when it comes to border wall funding? You're just, there's no way Democrats are going to approve that? Or is that possible if, for example, President Trump introduces some other kind of measure, like, for example, ensuring protections for DACA recipients?
We need to ensure we protect our borders, but we also need to have sensible immigration policies on the books that respect our dreamers, that allow them to become full-fledged citizens of this country, and that look for ways to reform a broken system. So let's have that discussion, but I think it should be outside the realm of funding the government and keeping the doors of our federal government open. That's a side discussion that shouldn't be all wrapped up with doing our basic job of keeping government open.
So I just want to be clear. Are you willing to accept any spending plan that includes funding for a border wall?
I wouldn't vote for any spending plan that includes the border wall. I think that's irresponsible. It's an idea that doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense. You know, the president of the campaign promised that a foreign power, Mexico, was going to pay for this border wall. So this is a bumper sticker slogan that's designed to play to a political base. I think what we need to do is focus on how we can secure the borders of this country, how we can reform a broken immigration system. But we shouldn't wrap this all up in a discussion over whether or not government should be open. There should be no question about that. So let's end this shutdown, and then let's get to the point where we can have a more robust discussion about how we move forward on immigration and on border security.
The president, though, does have the support of many people in your district, and building the wall was one of his signature priorities. Should you at least consider that this should be part of a deal here? The wall should be part of a deal?
Well, we don't really know what we're talking about when he says border wall. I think it's a bumper sticker slogan that is not really fleshed out. I sat on the executive council for 6 years. We dealt with infrastructure projects. We wouldn't vote for a contract for a project or to fund a specific priority unless we saw plans, unless we exactly understood what was being discussed. So I think it's really irresponsible for Congress just to throw some money at something to please the president. That's not how this process should work. I think we should be fiscally responsible and thoughtful about how we can make sure that we have border security, that we invest in the manpower and technology that we need along our southern border to keep America safe. But I don't believe a wall achieves that.
You've said that you will not take a congressional salary during the shutdown. Can you talk a little bit about that decision?
I think that Congress has a job to do, and it is not doing it today. So I think until Congress does its job, it shouldn't get paid. We have 800,000 federal workers who are on the job without a paycheck or have been furloughed. They deserve us to be looking out for them. I ran a small business, and I wouldn't feel comfortable getting paid while my employees weren't. So I think it's an important message to send that, we have a job to do in Congress, and that until we do it, we shouldn't be receiving a paycheck because hundreds of thousands of workers are without one. You know, our government told some of these workers that they should barter for their mortgage or for their rent. That's just a ridiculous statement, and it just shows how misguided this shutdown is. And I just can't believe we've reached this moment where that's the message that we're sending to our federal workers. We should be telling them that we support them, that we thank them for their service, that we'll do everything we can to make sure that they get paid on time. And Congress isn't doing that today.
Will you get back pay when the government is reopened?
I'll donate my pay during the shutdown to charity, and we'll figure out a good local charity to donate it to. I think it's really important that Congress steps up to its responsibilities. And yesterday we had a new Congress that was sworn in. There's an immense amount of responsibility on the shoulders of each and every one of us. And, until we really deliver in the way that the American people are looking for, until we're able to reopen the doors of government, I don't feel comfortable getting compensated for that time. So I'm not going to be receiving back pay. I'll be donating my salary to charity during the duration of this shutdown.
You joined the vast majority of House Democrats yesterday in reelecting Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House, but you were reluctant to fully back her until a few weeks after the election. You talked about the need to get new voices into leadership. Are you confident that that can still happen?
I believe we've done that, and we've identified some individuals who have become part of the leadership team who represent the future of the Democratic Party.
Can you let us know about who those people are?
Sure. Catherine Clark from Massachusetts, Ben Ray Luon from New Mexico. In addition to that, we have two freshman representative liaisons to leadership, Katie Hill and Joe Neguse, who are doing a great job speaking up for the large freshman class. This is the biggest incoming class of Democrats since Watergate. And before I voted for individuals for leadership, I wanted to make sure that the freshman class would be empowered, that our voices would be heard, that we'd be communicating on behalf of the caucus, that we'd be able to get the committee assignments that we wanted. And we received those assurances from Speaker Pelosi and from others on her team. So I feel confident that we're going to go forward in a united way, where those of us who were just elected in November are going to be able to file legislation and be an active participant in the work of the House.
Many of your colleagues in the House are talking about launching investigations into the Trump administration. Are there areas where you think there needs to be an investigation?
Well, I think we have gone through the last couple years without the adequate level of oversight, which is Congress's responsibility. There's a natural tension that's set up in our system between the legislative and executive branches. But it requires Congress to be on its toes and to be willing to, call department heads before committees to make sure that the rule of law is followed. And I don't believe that's always been the case. So I think we can own up to that responsibility without it becoming political. And I believe that's the direction this House is going to go in. So I think we need to make sure that we're meeting that responsibility and let the chips fall where they may.
Mm-hmm. And should Democrats be cautious about going too far with these investigations?
I think in any investigation, you need to let the facts lead you in the right direction and lead you to any conclusion. So I think as long as this Congress is motivated by facts and not politics, that it's motivated by its constitutional responsibility and not just playing gotcha politics with the president or with anyone else, then we're going to be on a strong, solid footing. And I think that's ultimately what the voters were looking for in this election. I got elected because people were looking for checks and balances. They were disturbed at some of the policies they saw being pushed in Washington. They wanted to make sure that President Trump and leaders in Congress didn't have a blank check. And I'm willing to work with anyone to get the job done for the people of New Hampshire, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, whether it's the president or anyone in Congress. But I'll also be willing to stand up to anyone when they're wrong or when they're pushing something that goes against what the people of New Hampshire are looking for. And I think that's got to be how we conduct ourselves.
What about impeachment of the president? The ongoing Robert Mueller probe has led some to say, especially opponents of President Trump, that impeachment might be in order depending on what Robert Mueller finds. Do you see impeachment as a legitimate possibility?
I don't at this point because we really need to see the report that Mueller produces, and it needs to be able to see the light of day. I remain concerned that the investigation doesn't have the level of protection that it needs, that there is potential that the Department of Justice, that the Office of the President could meddle in this investigation. And so I think it's important that Congress passes legislation to protect the independence and integrity of Mueller's work. Once he is finished his work, let's see what he's produced. There's certainly been a lot of activity in court. There have been many guilty pleas. There have been indictments. There have been convictions. And we need to make sure that everything is put out on the table so that the American people can see what has transpired the last couple years.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of policy, aside from having to deal with the government shutdown, what are going to be your areas of focus heading into this first term?
Well, I'm excited that H.R. 1, which is the first major piece of legislation beyond the shutdown bills, that's going to come through Congress, is a signature priority of mine. We need to make sure that we protect voting rights, that we end the influence of big corporate special interest money in our elections, and that we look for ways to reform the ethics of the House and look for ways to end the culture of corruption that exists in Washington, D.C. So H.R. 1 was filed yesterday. We'll have some hearings on it coming forward over the next several weeks, and I look forward to being a champion for that piece of legislation. In addition to that, there are a number of other bills that I'm looking to participate in. We all know that the opioid crisis continues to ravage New Hampshire, and we need more than just lip service to make sure that we have opportunities of treatment and recovery for the people in the Granite State, and I want to look for ways to do that. In addition to that, we continue to have shortcomings in the VA, and I want to work with the leadership of the Manchester VA to make sure that they have the resources they need to improve the quality of care that is offered there. So I'm really eagerly awaiting the committee assignments. We've been told that over the next couple weeks, those committee assignments will be made. And so then I'll know some pretty specific policy areas that I'll be digging into as a member of two committees.
Congressman Chris Pappas, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for your time.
It's Congressman Chris Pappas. I spoke with him earlier this morning. We're here in the studio with Union Leader reporter Kevin Landrigan, Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. So I'll turn to you now for your thoughts on what Congressman Pappas had to say. We'll start with you, Dean. What do you think?
That was a very comprehensive interview. I think it gave us a really good sense of how Chris Pappas sees himself fitting into the new Congress and the new Democratic majority in the House. I thought it was very interesting that he's made this decision about withholding his own paycheck. I did not know he was going to donate it to charity. I thought perhaps he would take the payment after the shutdown was over. This is something that's been a topic of debate, a number of different individuals. Nikki Haley, the former UN ambassador, just tweeted out that members of Congress should not take payment during the shutdown. So there's been some back and forth about whether or not people should be paid in Congress. So I thought it was interesting that he's made that decision on his own. You know, we've got a pretty good sense of his priorities. He's talked before about voting rights and corruption and campaign finance reform, and also his desire to focus on armed services and veterans affairs and also infrastructure. You know, the biggest challenge for Chris Pappas is he's a freshman member of Congress. The House of Representatives is an extremely hierarchical body in comparison to the Senate. Nancy Pelosi traditionally has been a strong leader, and typically he will find himself voting with the leadership 94-95% of the time. And so it's a very different dynamic than being a U.S. senator. You don't have the kind of ability to be a free agent and freelance that you might in the other chamber. That said, I think he has a pretty good idea. He seems to be someone who's interested in working as part of a larger team, and that's really what he's going to have to do.
Kevin?
A couple of things. He serves in a Republican-leaning seat, and as such, in 2020, he'll be a targeted first-term congressman. So you heard a lot of caution from Congressman Pappas in these answers, and and rightfully so, because he's going to have to deal with a tough re-election fight in 2020. There isn't any question about it. I mean, just to put some context into that, with this huge new class in U.S. House of Democrats, there are only 20 Democrats, new Democrats, who voted for Pelosi, who serve in districts that Trump won, and Pappas is one of them. So that's the context for him politically. That's what he has to be concerned about going forward. This issue of not taking the money during a shutdown, the money still gets paid. The 27th Amendment to the Constitution says the Congress shall be paid, even if the money isn't appropriated. The Congress shall be paid. That amendment was put into place so that Congress essentially couldn't vote its own pay raise while they were in session. That's why they adopted this amendment. So when the shutdown is over, those checks will go to Congressman Pappas, as they do to a number of members of Congress who are not turning it down. At that point, he's got three options: take the money, donate it to charity, or give it back to the Treasury. And he's chosen a charitable option.
Mm-hmm. And to Kevin's point about kind of the re-election fight that he's facing in 2020, you know, I think it's kind of telling for Chris Pappas' position that more than half of your interview was spent on the shutdown and on border security. That's not exactly great territory for Chris Pappas to stake out a sort of position as an independent member of Congress at this point. It's usually something that you don't normally inherit between, I don't know if it ever has happened, between classes in the House. We've had a few shutdowns, but this is a case where he has a list of priorities. He kind of enumerated them at the end, and yet that's not what the narrative is in Washington right now. And a lot of this, these negotiations are obviously happening at the highest levels. And so he, in a lot of ways, he has to toe Nancy Pelosi's line right out the gate. And he has to kind of, or he seems like he's making the choice to kind of stand with her on the position of whether there should be funding for a wall. And so his other positions that might be more nuanced, that might kind of cross to independent and even right-leaning voters, they're not being heard right now.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting. I thought Kevin made a really good point about the challenges he'll face in re-election and how that may lead to him being a little more cautious. My sense of him in terms of leadership style and temperament has always been that he's a fairly cautious fellow. He was in the congressional campaign. He was on the executive council. He always sort of tended to take kind of a, we'll see, let's wait and see, and then we'll make a careful decision. So I think that if that's his temperament by nature, I think it'll fit well with the electoral reality you just described.
And as we welcomed Chris Pappas to Congress this week, we said farewell to Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter, who spoke on NHPR's Morning Edition this week and gave some advice that she would give to her successor, Chris Pappas.
The advice that I would give anybody is, you know, every day get up with a sense of awe that you get to do this, and to remember that no matter what is happening in the moment, that, you know, you're part of history and that there's great challenges and this country's depending on you and everybody else to work together to get it done. There is a lot of trouble there. I'm not trying to say that there isn't. There's a lot of division and a lot of trouble, but there's also a path forward. And so, you know, find that path. I believe that Chris already knows that, and I believe he'll do a good job. I think he's going to be just fine there.
So that's Carol Shea Porter speaking on NHPR's Morning Edition this morning. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Still to come, a few more stories to discuss after the break. Among them, a restaurant in Keene is fighting the city over its name. The city says the restaurant's name sounds like a profanity. The name, and I have got clearance from the folks at NHPR to say this on the air, is Pho Keene Great, P-H-O. That's a soup. We want to hear from you. Is this name offensive, as the city manager of Keene alleges? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org or watch the video of this radio broadcast at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. We'll be right back.
Every convention about how true crime stories usually unfold is upended.
That's why Bear Brook, the latest podcast from NHPR, has been downloaded more than a million times.
30 years ago this month, a mystery began.
It's the story of a decades-old cold case that's changing how murders will be investigated forever, reported by NHPR's own Jason Moon.
This story is not going to go the way you think it is.
Download it now or check it out at bearbrookpodcast.com.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor, Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis of SNHU. And with you, give us a call if you have questions or comments about the week's news. There's still a little bit of time. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Right before the break, we heard from Carol Shea Porter. She gave an exit interview of sorts to NHPR's Rick Ganley this week. But really quickly, Dean, your thoughts on Carol Shea Porter's legacy.
Sure. I think that the word that people will use now that she's leaving her roughly 10-year period of serving in and out of office is tenacious. There are many times her political obituary was written in the elections, and she managed to come back and win. She was a very early progressive, anti-Iraq war activist, was in from in 06 to 10, then out, then in 12 to 14, then out, then in 16 to 18. So she managed to negotiate with tenacity a very difficult electoral landscape in that first CD. She's a very genuine person. I've interviewed her many times, and she does not really speak like a politician, and I think people appreciated that. And she talks about health care and equal rights and financial aid as some of her legacy. Again, I think she'll be remembered as somebody who was tenacious and was able to navigate a very difficult electoral stretch in that first CD.
And we'll move on now to a few more stories of note this week. One of them, Kevin, you reported on for the Union Leader, which is that a few members of the GOP, supporters of President Trump, had made a push to support the president in the GOP presidential primary if the president does have a challenger. But many party leaders objected to that. They want the party to remain neutral during the primary, and it seems like those folks prevailed, Kevin.
Yeah, they did. Essentially, these very strong supporters of Trump, like this president, are very focused on 2020. So much of what you can tell the president in the White House right now, so much of what he does, this fight over the wall, is really all about 2020 and keeping his base happy and well-stoked. And these folks are a part of his base and don't want to see a serious challenge emerge in 2020 during the presidential primary. This rule would have required party officers to support the incumbent president, which was sort of antithetical to both the tradition the Republican has of very open primaries, but also not helpful at all to New Hampshire's image in terms of our first-in-the-nation primary and welcoming all candidates to run, whether they're incumbents or whether they have much of a chance of winning or not. We're a welcoming state, and our primary, I think, is fostered through that tradition. So these folks understood to change the bylaws takes a two-thirds vote. When Governor Sununu came out against it, for some of the reasons I expressed, I think they understood it's not likely to pass. They still believe it should be looked at in the future. It's also really good news for the leading candidate for Republican state chairman, Steve Stepanek. He's a former co-chairman of Trump in 2016. This issue was making him really uncomfortable because he's trying to appeal to the broad range of Republicans that will vote on this chairmanship on January 26th, but at the same time not alienate the real Trump devotees who wanted to make this change.
Dean, your thoughts?
Yeah, this is the whole issue of protecting the New Hampshire primary and keeping it fair and open. I think people were concerned. Certainly, we heard concern among some Republicans who have been involved in protecting the primary that this was not a smart move long term. And it's interesting. We're also seeing a little bit of drama on the Democratic side. Governor Jay Inslee of Washington, looks like he's gearing up to run for the Democratic nomination for presidency, a campaign largely focused on climate change. I think we're actually also going to see the Washington Senator Jeff Merkley potentially run as well. So we may have two folks from Washington State out here. Well, in any event, Jay Inslee was the head of the Democratic Governors Association in this last election cycle. The DGA did not give any money to Molly Kelly, whereas the RGA, Republican Governors Association, gave a fair chunk of money at the last minute to Governor Sununu in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so Ray Buckley is publicly expressing his displeasure with Inslee and suggesting that when he comes here, he's going to need to explain himself. And that, along the same lines of party chairs and parties remaining neutral, was a very interesting development. So I think for those people who are interested in protecting the primary, the idea has always been that the party officials stay out of it.
Other stories that made headlines this week, New Hampshire businesses will pay less in taxes starting today as a new round of tax cuts go into effect. This is the third reduction in recent years. Republicans, including Governor Chris Sununu, say the cuts are necessary to spur economic growth and create jobs. Business taxes are the single largest source of funding for state government. As long as revenue meets certain targets, another round of cuts will kick in 2021. As we said earlier in the program, top Democrats do plan to introduce bills this session to reverse some of the recent cuts, arguing that the state needs the money to invest in the opioid epidemic and workforce issues. Also in the news this week, Dartmouth College released additional plans to combat sexual violence yesterday. The school is facing a federal Title IX lawsuit claiming members of its psychology faculty harassed and assaulted students for years. President Phil Hanlon now says Dartmouth will require additional training for faculty and staff, put more money toward mental health and diversity programs, and establish an external committee to improve accountability around sexual harassment issues. And finally, a controversial business name in Keene caused quite a stir this week. A restaurant that's opening soon put a sign up calling itself Pho Keene Great, named after the Vietnamese soup spelled P-H-O, pronounced pho. City manager Elizabeth Dragon didn't take kindly to this play on words.
You know, we're trying to do all that we can to make sure that she's successful in her business. And it's just we have to strike a balance because it is a public building.
So trying to strike a balance. The sign outside the restaurant has since come down. This was done per order of the city, according to the restaurant. But, Ethan, it's a story that's gotten a lot of attention because it's clever. It's a clever name.
Sure. And it's something that will be interesting to see kind of what the next steps are. You know, there potentially could be a legal challenge. One kind of nuance, though, to throw in there is that the issue with the name appears to not necessarily be kind of falling afoul of the city's sign policies, but specifically the city's lease with this building, which kind of went further than the overall city policy. So if you were to take a lawsuit, you would kind of be fighting against the lease itself, which the city manager has said in previous interviews was much more explicit in terms of what could be what would be appropriate and what wouldn't be. So the city manager is arguing that where another business that wasn't renting directly from a building operated by the city might have been able to put up a sign like this, this particular building and this particular lease stops that. So we'll see how that plays out and kind of to what extent the challenge goes further.
Yeah, I mean, apparently there have been some meetings scheduled between both sides of this dispute, but the restaurant owner keeps delaying, which some have interpreted, and we don't know if this is correct, that means, okay, maybe there are consultations with a lawyer happening here, that the lawyer keeps saying, wait a minute, we got to think a little bit more about this.
Sure. And in the meantime, there's been national headlines that surround this, and so, you know, certainly the buzz around the business is growing. As somebody who used to live in Keene, and knows the spot that they're taking over well, I think that Keene is way overdue for a good noodle place.
Well, good noodle place. Okay, well, we did have a caller who wanted to comment but couldn't stay on the line. Linda, who said it should be called Great Faux Keene, apparently indicating that this is good for the business scene in Keene. We have to leave it there, but I want to thank everybody for being here today. Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, and Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor. Thanks very much for being here on the program. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
Have a great weekend.
And listeners, coming up on Monday on The Exchange, I'm filling in for Laura Kanoy, and we're going to be talking about health, diet, fitness, and New Year's resolutions to get in shape. This is one of the most popular and, for some people, perennial New Year's resolutions. Lose some weight, improve physical health, maintain it. What trips you up and what questions do you have about your physical health? What would you like to accomplish in the new year? Send us a note by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Remember, the conversation about the stories we discuss continues online today at nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.